Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24. My guest today is Gay Talese, writer, author, godfather of narrative non-fiction, but ultimately a reporter. He's famous for his celebrity profiles, particularly one epic story about Frank Sinatra, called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, which he wrote for Esquire back in 1966. But some of his greatest writing has been about lesser-known characters. A crime family in Honour Thy Father, the obituary writer at the New York Times in The Kingdom and the Power, and his new book, The Voyeur's Motel, which tells the story of a motel owner who spied on his guests having sex. Sex is another familiar Talese subject. For his book, Thy Neighbour's Wife, he owned a massage parlour and participated in swingers' parties. He is a reporter who immerses himself in his subject, someone who takes his time to get things right. And at 84, he's still watching, still reporting, still writing. And I'm delighted to say that Gay Talese joins me here today in New York. Gay Talese, thank you very much for joining us today. Can I start with, I guess, a sort of a basic question, but maybe a big question. Why do you write?
I write because it gives me an excuse. I'm a nonfiction writer now. The distinction between fiction and nonfiction, as you know, is paramount and very, very important to me. I don't make anything up. I don't use my imagination. I believe that imagination is an anathema to the business I practice, which is nonfiction, reality writing. And in order to do the reality writing I say I do, I have to be there. I have to meet people. I have to travel. And I love it because I get outside myself. And that's one of the reasons I write, is to get outside myself. Many writers, particularly fiction, they write to get inside themselves. I want to get outside myself because too often writers become internalized. They spend too much time at home, too much time with themselves, particularly now in the technology that overwhelms most societies, at least in the Western world. The use of technology becomes so narcissistic, so inward tortured, so limiting to one's experiences, often one's home. People can sit there behind a laptop at breakfast and communicate to the Taliban. I mean, you can cover the news around the world without putting on your bathroom. It's just ridiculous. Because when I was a young man, an aspiring journalist, the credo of journalism, you have to be there. Get off your ass. Get out there. See people. See things that you didn't know you were going to see. Leave a lot to chance. It's serendipity. Nowadays, everything is so linear. It's so goal-oriented. You put your fingers on something, and the laptop will produce what you want. But what you want is not all that's there. So there's this kind of singular, goal-oriented, narrow-minded result. And I'm at 84, too old for that stuff, or maybe too young. But I'm a reporter. I'm a foot soldier to historians. That's what we are. All my life, I've written 14 books, and most of them are about people who are not really well known. There's an exception. Frank Sinatra is the greatest exception. I know you want to talk about that.
Well, in fact, what's interesting about the Frank Sinatra piece is that
I didn't talk to him.
Well, yeah, you didn't talk to him, but you talked to the minor characters.
And the reason I talked to the minor characters is because that's the one way I can get my story. And the second thing is I'm comfortable doing that. Many writers are intelligent people. They're part of academia or they're certainly educated, and they tend to be more comfortable with speaking to educated people. That's not true with me. I'm not that educated to begin with. I'm more of a very common person, and I come out of a very ordinary background. My father and mother were shopkeepers. And as a boy, I hung around with ordinary people who came in to get buy dresses, my mother's customers, in a small town in New Jersey near Atlantic City. It was called Ocean City. It's an island resort made up of a lot of Anglo-Saxon families, a very WASPy town. We were Italians. My father was an immigrant from Italy. So we were part of the service of the city. Main Street, my father's tailor shop. Next to it was my mother's dress shop. As a boy, 10 or 11 or 12, I'd hang around the store servicing certain things. My mother said, get this young lady an iced tea, and I'd run the street and get one. Or I'd wrap up the boxes. But I became to be comfortable with strangers, older people, customers. Also, I was trained from my parents to be very polite to customers. Do not interrupt conversations when you hear your mother and father talking to a customer. Do not ask questions to the customer. Don't ask unless you're answering questions. Be very polite. This is perfect for journalism. And what's good manners, first of all, you have to get your foot in the door. you have to show up, right? But people have to talk to you, and they don't know you. And maybe you don't even know them either. But you have to make a bridge, a conversational bridge. And the training that I got is much more valuable than if I went to some fancy college or journalism department or journalism school.
You mentioned your parents and the fact that, you know, your father was a tailor, your mother ran a dress shop. And looking at you today, and indeed every time that we see you,
my father,
it's clear that was important to you.
Very important. And I grew up with that. And it also parlays into assistance in my journalism. My father, as I said, my mother, as I said, are people in clothes. Appearances matter to them. Appearances, fashion, style. And with that comes respect for other people. When you dress well, you're really dressing in accord with your respect for other people. People who have respect for themselves dress well. We who have respect for people, when they die, dress them well in a casket. And my question often, if you dress well for a funeral, why don't you dress well when you stay alive? This is not really true, most people. Most people, including younger people, are in the uniform of blue jeans, are in a way anti-fashion because they're so uniform in their lack of fashion, meaning blue jeans, which I never owned one in my life. They have no sense of pride in just being alive. I always had that sense of pride in being alive, but also the sense of pride in being a journalist. And when I knock on someone's door or I meet someone for an appointment, for an interview, I dress for that. Why? I'm dressing for the story. I'm not only dressing for me and the person that I'm with for an interview, but the story is worthy of great respect because I take great pride in being a storyteller. And the people who are journalists, I was most of my life on a newspaper or a magazine, I always felt that I'm representing my career. I'm representing my avocation. And it's a wonderful thing to be a journalist, because what you're doing, if you're doing it right, is trying to tell the truth. In a city of lies, in a nation of liars, you're trying to tell the truth. Governments are liars. The priesthood is liars. Wall Street is full of liars. Everything is penetrated with deception, advertising, propaganda, distortion, taking advantage by getting wrong information in the wrong place at the right time. All of this is contrary to the way I was reared as a young journalist when I started at the New York Times in 1956.
Let's talk a bit about how you work, because you've worked in pretty much the same way since day one, haven't you, in terms of what you make notes on, these bits of cardboard. You've got them in your pocket right now.
Sure. These are just shirt boards that anybody who goes to a laundry gets shirts delivered or picks up shirts at a laundry. There's a piece of cardboard, flat piece of cardboard behind to keep the shirt in place. It's folded, as you know. And then I take those flats of shortbread. I cut them up, five sections of it, nice round out the edges, and I fit them right in my breast pocket of my jacket. I always have a jacket, incidentally. And when I go to interview people, I'll write a note or two, but very subtly. I don't want to write in front of people all the time unless I
You don't want to have a reporter's notepad in front of you writing things down.
That's, first of all, a little wire thing always gets caught, you know, little, and I don't like it. And I don't even, in front of people, take many notes as it is.
Really?
What I want, I just
but
want to.
Is that a problem for dialogue? In that, you know, there might be times where you've forgotten exactly
what
was said.
When I want to quote somebody, I wouldn't do it with a tape recorder, and I wouldn't even write it on my little cards. But on my cards, I'll have little reminders of what I found interesting. Then I go back to that person. So you know, when we're walking down the street, when I accompany you to Walmart or something, and I like to follow people around and be part of their day. I said, you said something about something. Let's try to use that because it's really interesting. And what I'd like to do is tell you what I thought I heard, but then you tell me and help me make it more accurate and more fully reflective of what you feel. You see, when you have a tape recorder, and let's say you're talking to some movie actor in a hotel with a press agent nearby, and you ask him a question, they give you an answer. Well, you are stuck with that answer. It's on tape, and that movie guy really has controlled the interview. Because in doing that, having this tape, he and his lawyer and the movie company says that's how George Clooney answered that, okay? It just takes time, but it's very, very much more interesting to read a quote that's readable and insightful than the little blippy stuff you get off a tape recorder.
You talk about taking time, and you take time in your writing as well, don't you?
Sure.
How much do you write?
The stages are, number one, You have to be curious about something. Okay, we have to have that. We are having. Anybody in my business is curious. Second, get off your ass and go to that place. That's important. You can go out there, and I go out there, and get all this wonderful stuff after. And I type every day I'm on an assignment. I type what I saw, what I thought, what I heard. You know.
So you do that at the end of every day?
Yeah. At the end of every day, when I'm home alone, either on a hotel or motel or my own house or somewhere, I get on my little typewriter. I still use a typewriter. And I type what that day. I put the date on there, where I was, who I saw, what I thought, what I felt, what I heard, all of that. Like a little diary. Then I do it a second day, a third day. And I get a sense of where we begin, where we're going, and finally how we're going to end. What does it mean? That's choreographed. You know what it is? It's like choreography. Gene Kelly sings Singing in the Rain. We watch it in the movie. It's the most joyous 3 minutes. Oh, how easy. I'd love to do that myself. The guy took a month, 2 months maybe, to do that one dance. So many repeats, choreographed every step. The rain hits the shoe here. He steps on the curb. He does it. The elbows the umbrella. Looks at the police officer. That whole thing, which looks on film like a day, just a day of joy in the rain, probably was 2 months of work. Athletes make it look easy. Writers make it look, if they're good writers, make it look easy too. It's not easy. It's hard. Everything is precisely organized. Everything is choreographed. So this process we call organization precedes the writing.
You're a reporter. But then in the book, Thy Neighbor's Wife, you're a character. You're involved.
Yeah, it's true. There are times when you are a reporter, but you have to explain to the readership, since I said I'm a nonfiction reporter, I'm not Ian McEwan making it up or Margaret Atwood. I'm not making anything up. I'm a goddamn reporter. I'm not a person of the imagination. Well, the reader says, if you're not a person of the imagination, you're not how come this looks like you're making it up? How do you know in Thy Neighbor's Wife that this wonderful orgy was taking place with Dr. Alex Comfort, the famous gerontologist who wrote Joy of Sex? Because I was there. You were there? Yeah, I was there. My clothes are off. I'm part of the orgy. Oh, you were the orgy. Well, at least I verify and give some kind of credentials to myself as an observer. And I'm both an observer and a participant at times. I mean, if I'm writing about nudity, I'm a nudist. I was a nudist. If I'm writing about sexual orgies, I'm at the orgy. I'm not sitting in the press box at a distance. I am there. I am there. And then what I have to do, in my book, I have to say, I was there. And I don't think, I'm a married man, have young daughters when I wrote that book. I said, either I'm going to do this right or not do it at all. If you're too shy or too self-protective to try to tell the reader that you know all you know, but you weren't there because you're embarrassed because you ran massage parlors as they did, or you hung around nudist orgy lands like I did. If you don't do it. Become a lawyer or get a job in social education, do something else.
Did your wife accept that explanation?
Yeah, she accepted that.
Did she?
Yeah. Well, she would not. I'm not saying she's thrilled. I mean, understand, but you could say that is never what breaks up a marriage. What breaks up a marriage is other things. And we have another program on marriage. I'm your authority. But what, in short, my wife of 57 years knew what she was marrying. When I was going to get married, I didn't want to get married. I said, darling, I want a big life. I'm not going to be like my parents, my mother and father in the tailor shop and dress shop. And at night, they're in the same place and they traveled together. I said, I want a big life. I want to move around a lot of social circles. I'm not going to be stuck in any kind of social life or social level. I wanted to have great traveling opportunities. I wanted a visa to get anywhere. I wanted to. And she understood that. My love for her transcends any of this frolicking. She knew that. Not many people would know that. That's why our marriage stays together.
We'll come back to the book about your marriage in a moment. But on this new book, The Voyeur's Motel, what he was doing was illegal.
Absolutely.
He was spying on people.
Of course it was.
But you were colluding with him.
Oh, I'm illegal too.
How did you wrestle with that?
When I was doing Thy Neighbor's Wife, I'll come back to it. I was running massage parlors. I was a pimp. Massage parlors are mercenary sexuality. Men were getting masturbated. You think that's legal? Not only that, oral sex was going on. I was in the middle of the den of impurity by my Catholic training. Oh, my God. There was nothing legal about what I did, except my standards are not legal or illegal. I wrote a great book about gangsters. Talking about illegal. Honor thy father. I was in the underworld with the Bonanno crime family for 4 years. From 1965 to 1971, I was in organized crime, participating not in killing people, but certainly observing killers and befriending killers and taking them to lunch.
Do you ever think that's a line which I won't cross?
No. No, I'm not beholden to any government, any priest.
But to yourself, do you think actually...
No. I'm in quest of human nature's information. I'm curious and I want to know what's the truth. And sometimes it's a sordid truth. Sometimes it's a happy truth or an admirable truth. And sometimes it's utterly disgusting. And sometimes the way I behave and what I write about is utterly disgusting.
And yet just then, when we were talking about Online Father, you said I was involved in organized crime. Oh, but, well, you know, I didn't kill anyone. But so in a sense, there was a line there for you.
Well, there was a line there because I don't own a gun. I guess it'd be hard to kill anyone. But I wasn't intending to kill anyone. But what I was intending to do is hang around and get to know killers, because my whole way of working is hanging out. The art of hanging out is what I do describe. If you're going to not hang out with killers or gangsters, well, then don't write about them. If you're not going to hang around with nude sexual freaks, then don't write about sexual freaks or adulterers, as they did in Thy Neighbor's Wife is about adultery. Adultery. It's not about happily married couples going into midlife and older life and worrying about Viagra. It's not about Viagra. It's about lusty, young, adulterous people. In the book here that I'm bringing out, that my publisher at Grove Atlantic is bringing out, called The Voyeur's Motel, the voyeur himself one time is up there in his attic looking at people, as he did all the time, and kept records, I should have said. Mm. But one time he saw a drug dealer selling drugs from the motel room to high school kids. A block away was a high school from this motel on the suburbs of Denver, Colorado. This voyeur, Gerald Foose is his name. I tell you, his wife is a nurse and he had two children. He's up there and he sees drugs being sold to high school students and he becomes angry. So when the voyeur, it was a college dropout was doing, this drug pusher and his girlfriend leave the room. The voyeur comes down from the attic, takes the ladder down through the laundry room and then sneaks into the bedroom where the drug dealer and his girlfriend had been staying for 4 or 5 days. He takes the drugs, he knew where they were hidden, flushes everything down the toilet. A couple hours later, the couple return. The voyeur's upstairs in the attic looking down again. And the drug guy sees that what is valuable to him has been missing. Someone stole it. And he blames the girlfriend. He says, "You're the only one that knows." She says, "I don't know where they are." "Yes, you do know. You told me. I know you don't want me to do this. And you said you get out of this drug business. But you give me that back." "Well, I don't have it. I don't know where it is." He didn't believe it. He's in a fight. He slaps her. She kicks him in the groin. She gets really mad. He slaps her and puts his arm around her neck. "You do this or I'm going to kill you." And the damn voyeur is upstairs doing nothing, silently participating in what he's hearing, but not moving an inch. She struggles and he finally drops her on the floor and she falls back on her back and falls on the floor next to the bed. And she was out. Upstairs, the voyeur thinks, "Well, I think she'll be all right. She looks like she's breathing." The voyeur, the drug guy, leaves the room, slams the door, took some money out of her pocket, incidentally, and disappears. The guy voyeur, who's really indirectly responsible for this damn, does nothing, zero up there, because he doesn't want to come down and interfere because he's a voyeur. He feels, "I'm not really here. I'm a secret entity. I'm nothing. I'm a zero man." He goes down the ladder, across the courtyard to where he lived. His office was behind, domestic quarters with his wife was behind the office. His wife is a nurse, I told you. She comes back from the night shift around 2 a.m. He says, "Boy, I had an awful thing happen," and he describes it. And she said, "Is she alive?" He said, "I think she looks like she's breathing." "Well," she says, "she's breathing." "Then all right," he says, "don't worry about it. Emergency room every damn night, somebody's coming in with blood, and husbands are killing their wives and vice versa." So next morning, the maid that goes into that room to clean it and sees the woman on her back as she was when the voyeur last saw her the night before. And the voyeur says, "Oh, God," the cleaning lady says, "I think she's..." Voyeur sends his wife comes back, "That woman is dead. Boy, we have to call the police. We have to call the coroner. We have to... Please come." And the voyeur says, "You know, I don't know what was going on, but I think there were some noises." He doesn't say he saw it. He said, "And I have it written down, the license of the car," which he got. They go to check the license of the car, and it's a stolen vehicle with a phony license, and the guy had used a phony name, phony address. So they have no record. The voyeur kept his mouth shut. The coroner comes and takes the body away. no report in the police department, apparently, though they should have been. This all happened in 1977. The voyeur didn't get in contact with me until 1980 when he told me he saw Thy Neighbor's Wife. And he wrote me like, boy, what a book that is. You should have talked to me because I could have told you things. Now we're jumping to 2013, do you understand? When he came to me and said, I can write about it. I said, you know that thing that happened in 1977? I'm going to look up the record of the police. He said, well, I don't mind because I feel as an ex-Catholic, I need some peace of mind and redemption. I hope I get redemption. I'm sort of guilty. I know I'm guilty. But and cowardly I was too, he said. And maybe if they find out this guy, maybe I'll feel better. I go to the police department in Denver. I go to the coroner's office. I go to and the Denver Post obituary. There's no record of this woman's death back in 1977. And the police said, well, we don't have records so good because that was before we used computers. And the voyeur said, well, she just seemed to fall through the cracks, meaning this victim, woman victim. The point is, I never knew whether that killer is still alive. The voyeur is still alive and still harbors a kind of, or accepts a certain responsibility. But on the other hand, yes, if he came down, rushing down, he could have broken it up. That's true. But he didn't. So now what? And then when that book comes out, there's another guy, me, and the readers. How come Gates Elise didn't, when he found out, didn't go to the police and say, I know this guy, this little voyeur guy. I know let's arrest him. I didn't. Why didn't I do it? I didn't do it because when I found out about it, it was 20, 30 years. So, and what am I? I don't feel guilty, but somebody said you should. You know, you're assuming no responsibility for what you knew. But I didn't know it in 1977. I didn't know the voyeur until 1980. And I didn't learn about it until 2013. Still, there are those who think I'm part of this demented, this perverted man. And that's legitimate because everything I write about, whether it's Bill Bonanno, the gangster, whether it's the pornographers that I wrote about and the sex swinging clubs that I wrote about in Thy Neighbor's Wife, or what I do here now in a voyeur's motel, I'm a part of the slime that I write so beautifully about. And to agree, that's true.
Let's go back just finally to your marriage. You say, you know, this book that you're now going back to. How easy or difficult have you found it to try and write honestly about the state of your marriage?
Easy.
Yeah?
Sure. Because two things you should know. One, when I got married in 1959, after much vacillation, should I, shouldn't I, how can I marry? I was reared a Catholic. And so my wife, Nan, not only reared a Catholic, she went to a Sacred Heart convent, a convent school, a college as well. Manhattanville, Sacred Heart, all over the world are these Sacred Heart connected institutions. And how can I marry into such an arrangement with a highly moral and very religious person? I had, when I was 24, 23, I got married. I wasn't a very religious person, but I had religious tradition, altar boy and all that stuff. Peter O'Toole, my background are not uncommon. It's very strict Irish Catholic nuns. Both he and I had Irish Catholic nuns, me in New Jersey.
But you enjoyed doing that piece with Peter O'Toole, didn't you?
That's the best fun I ever had in my life, Peter O'Toole. He was the most intelligent man I ever interviewed. He was the most joyful, the most free-spirited. I loved him. I really loved him. Most of the people I write about, I don't love them.
Did you ever try to do another interview with him later?
I sure did. Funny you should ask that question. I did. I went to Esquire where I wrote that piece. Came out in the early 1960s when he was finished Lawrence of Arabia and he was on the London stage about four years ago. He got an Academy Award and a supporting role. And I went to the editor of Esquire, a different guy than I wrote when I did O'Toole in 1962 or three it is. So when the boss at Esquire didn't want it.
In your book on the New York Times, which we briefly mentioned earlier, there was there's a wonderful chapter about the man who writes the obituaries.
Yeah.
Mr.
Bad News.
Mr. Bad News, yeah. Do you ever think about your own obituary and what it might be and what you would want it to be?
Yeah, but unfortunately, I can't write it. I mean, I wish I could, and I would if they asked me, but they won't. One time a guy, I'm going to go public with you on this because it bothers me. One time about 2 years ago, or maybe, I got a call from a New York Times reporter. And he called me. I said, oh, I'm sorry to bother you, Mr. Cleese, but I was assigned to do some information to be used in the obituary. I said, oh, well, do you want to make a date? Come over see me? And he said, no. I said, no? No. Well, how can you write an obituary if you don't even know the person? He said, well, I have your work. I said, my work isn't all of me. I mean, I have a life outside of my work. I am something more than my little scribblings done in private. Well, no, he didn't care. So I thought, this is the reporter. I'm sorry, I'm being so personal. But he's not going to hear this show anyway. What's the difference? But the point is, these guys don't want to get off their ass. It's what I am not. If I was going to write about somebody, an obituary in advance, and it's what it is, an advance obituary, I wouldn't want to talk to them on the phone. I want to go see them, what they look like.
And what would you hope it would say?
They would have to say something that we said today. My involvement is so intensely connected to what I'm doing that I take off my clothes, as I did in Thy Neighbor's Wife, that I convert with well-known killers and gangsters, as I did in the book about the mafia family called Honor Thy Father, that I hang around with a wretched, perverted voyeur and describe him in a negligent and unforgettably culpable moment when he watches murder and does nothing about it. The people I associate with, not only associate with, but take all the time to write about with such care and with such dedication to doing my very best with prose. And some of these people are so disreputable, so disgusting, so, you know, I'm non-judgmental. The fact that what is the responsibility, one might ask, for the chronicler, for the observer, me? Does he not take any moral stand with people who are clearly immoral or disgusting? No. Yeah. But, I mean, that's a good debate. That question should be in my obituary. Who is this guy who spends 70 years of his writing life with so many unacceptably interesting, I mean, wrong side of the tracks and disgusting? Well, I am on the wrong side of the tracks. I told you at the beginning of the show, I don't see the world and don't want to see the world from the orthodox point of view of what's right and what's wrong, what's moral and what's immoral. I don't see it. And as a writer, I make no walls between myself and the reader. Everything the reader reads from me, they know where they got it. They know who I'm writing about. They know what I'm doing. They know where I got all the information. And they know if I have my clothes on or my clothes off. That's okay, because I want to be very naked about my work.
That's a perfect way to end. Gay Talese, thank you very much indeed.
My thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Steve Bloomfield, in conversation with Gay Talese. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty. It's researched by Guy Lutz, Megan Billings and Faith Barker, and edited by Nina Narek. My thanks also to Will Baker at the Chord Club Studios here in New York. The Big Interview returns next week. And don't forget, you can listen to all our big interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or of course, monocle.com/radio. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.